or to the correct stimulus. The fact that Dr. Henry Lee, my idol, was going to be 188.61 miles away from me, and I was not going to be able to meet him. In spite of my mother's assertions that if I went to college, I would have to go somewhere local, where I could live at home and benefit from her help and organization, I had long assumed that, one day, I'd apply to the University of New Haven, never mind that as a high school senior, I was already over a month past deadline. I would get into the criminalist program he'd founded there, where I would be plucked from undergraduate obscurity by Dr. Lee himself, who would notice my attention to detail and my inability to be distracted by girls or frat parties or loud music emanating from dorm windows, and would invite me to help solve a real current case and consider me his protege. Now, of course, I had an even more pressing reason to meet him. "Imagine, Dr. Lee," I would begin. "You've set up a crime scene to point to someone else's involvement and wind up a suspect yourself. And then together, we would analyze what might have been conceived differently to prevent it from happening the next time." My mother and I argue about the same things over and over, such as why she refuses to treat me normally. This would be a classic example, where she's taking my desire to see Dr. Lee and twisting it into a pretzel so that it seems like an unreasonable Aspie request, instead of one grounded in reality. There are many instances where I want to do things other kids my age do. 1. Get a license and drive a car. 2. Live on my own at college. 3. Go out with my friends without her having to call their parents first and explain my quirks. A. It should be noted, of course, that this would apply to a time when I currently had friends. 4. Get a job so that I have money for the above. A. It should be noted that she did let me get a job, and unfortunately, to date, the only people who've chosen to hire me were completely unreasonable asses who couldn't see the big picture, like whether being 5 minutes late on a shift is truly going to cause a global catastrophe. Instead, I watch Theo sail out the door while she waves goodbye to him. Unlike me, he'll be allowed to get his driver's license sooner or later. Imagine how incredibly humiliating it'll be for me to be driven around by my younger brother, the same child who used his own poop to paint a mural on the garage door once. My mother argued that I couldn't have it both ways. I could not ask to be treated like an ordinary 18-year-old and also demand clothing with tags cut out and refuse to drink orange juice because of its name. Maybe I did feel that I could have it both ways. Be disabled sometimes and normal at others. But then again, why couldn't I? Let's say that Theo sucked at growing vegetables but was really good at bowling. My mother might treat him like a slightly remedial student if she was teaching him to grow rutabagas, but when she hit the lanes with him, she'd ditch the slow voice. Not all humans have one standard, so why should I? At any rate, whether I've simply been cooped up too long or whether I'm suffering acute mental distress from my soon-to-be-missed opportunity with Dr. Lee, I do the only thing that seems justifiable at the time. I call 911 and tell them I am being abused by my mother.
Rich. It's like one of those pictures in celebrity magazines I read at the dentist's office. What's different? The first shot shows Jess Ogilvy with a big smile on her face and Mark McGuire's arm draped over her shoulder. It's a photograph we took from her nightstand. The second picture was taken by my CSI team and shows Jess with her eyes closed and ringed with bruises, her skin frozen a solid pale blue. She is draped with a postage stamp quilt that looks like a painter's color wheel. Ironically, she's wearing the same sweatshirt in both photos. There are obvious differences, the physical trauma being the biggest one. But there's something else about her I can't put my finger on. Did she lose weight? Not really. Was it the makeup? Nah, she wasn't wearing any in either shot. It's the hair. Not the cut, which would be easy. It's straight in the picture of Jess and her boyfriend. In the crime scene print, though, it's curled and frizzy, a cloud around her battered face. I pick up the photo and study it at close range. It seems likely that curls were the default setting for her hair, given that she would have gone to the trouble to style it when out with her boyfriend, which means that her hair got wet while the body was out in the elements, something easily assumed, except for the fact that she was protected from rain and snow by the concrete culvert where she was dumped. So her hair was wet when she was killed. And there was blood in the bathroom. Was Jacob a peeping Tom, too? Captain? I look up to find one of the street cops standing in front of me. Dispatch just got a call from a kid who says he's being abused by a parent. Don't need a detective for that, do you? No, Captain, it's just... the kid? He's the one you arrested for that murder. The photo flutters out of my hand onto the floor. You gotta be kidding, I mutter, and I stand up and grab my coat. I'll take care of it.
Jacob. Immediately, I realize I've made a colossal mistake. I begin hiding things, my computer, my file cabinet. I shred papers that are sitting on my desk and tuck a stash of journals from forensics associations in the bathtub. I figure all of these things can be used against me, and they've already taken so much of what was mine. I don't think I can be arrested again, but I'm not entirely sure. Double jeopardy only refers to the same crime and only after an acquittal. I will say this for the boys in blue. They are speedy. Less than 10 minutes after my 911 call, there's a knock at the door. My mother and Theo, who are still downstairs, trying to reinstall the fire alarm Theo set off with some abortive kitchen snack, are caught completely unawares. It's stupid, I know, but I hide underneath my bed.
Rich. What are you doing here? Emma Hunt demands. Actually, we received a call through 911. I didn't call 911. Jacob! She yells, and she turns on her heel and flies up the stairs. I step into the house to find Theo staring at me.
We don't want to donate to the Police Athletic League, he says sarcastically.
Thanks. I point up the staircase. I'm just going to go. Without waiting for him to answer, I head toward Jacob's room.
Abusing you? Emma is shrieking when I reach the doorway. You've never been abused a day in your life. There's physical abuse and there's mental abuse, Jacob argues.
Emma whips her head in my direction.
I have never laid a hand on that boy, although right now I'm incredibly tempted. I have three words for you, Jacob says. Dr. Henry Lee.
The forensic scientist? I'm completely not following.
He's speaking at UNH tomorrow, and she says I can't go.
Emma looks at me.
Do you see what I'm dealing with?
I purse my lips, thinking, let me talk to him alone for a minute.
Seriously? Her eyes widened. Were you not in the same courtroom I was in 3 hours ago? When the judge told you accommodations should have been made when you questioned Jacob?
I'm not questioning him now, I tell her. Not professionally, anyway. She throws up her hands.
I don't care. Do what you want, both of you.
When her last footstep fades down the stairs, I sit down beside Jacob. You know, you're not supposed to call 911 unless you're in serious trouble. He snorts.
So arrest me. Oh, wait, you already did.
You ever hear of the boy who cried wolf?
I didn't say anything about wolves, Jacob replies. I said I was being abused, and I am. This is the one chance I have to meet Dr. Lee, and she won't even consider it. If I'm old enough to be tried as an adult. How come I'm not old enough to walk to the bus stop and travel down there on my own?
You're old enough. You'll just wind up with your ass in jail again. Is that what you want? From the corner of my eye, I spy a laptop peeking out of a pillowcase. Why is your computer under the covers? He pulls it free and cradles it in his arms.
I thought you'd steal it from me, just like you took my other stuff.
I didn't steal that. I had a warrant to seize it. And you'll get it back one day. I glance at him. You know, Jacob, your mother is only protecting you.
By locking me up in here?
No, the judge did that. By not letting you break your bail requirements. We're both quiet for a second, and then Jacob glances at me from the corner of his eye.
I don't understand your voice.
What do you mean?
It should be angry because I made you come all the way out here. But it's not angry. And it wasn't angry when I talked to you at the police station either. You treated me like I was just a friend of yours. But then you arrested me at the end, and people don't arrest their friends.
He clasps his hands between his knees.
Frankly, people don't make sense to me.
I nod in agreement. Frankly, people don't make sense to me either, I say.
Theo. Why do the cops keep coming to our stupid house? I mean, given that they've already arrested Jacob, shouldn't they let justice take its course? Okay, I get that Jacob was the one to summon them this time, but surely a phone call would have been just as effective to get him to call off his request for help, and yet the police, this one guy in particular, keeps showing up. He chats up my mother, and now I can hear him yapping with Jacob about maggots that land on bodies within 10 minutes of death. Tell me how exactly this has any bearing on the 911 call, hmm? Here's what I think. Detective Mattson isn't here to talk to Jacob. He's certainly not here to talk to my mother. He's come because he knows that in order to get to Jacob's room, he has to pass mine. And that means at least 2 glimpses inside. Maybe someone has reported missing the Wii game I took. Maybe he's just waiting for me to crack, to fall at his feet and confess that I was at Jess Ogilvie's place shortly before my brother, so that he can tell that bitch prosecutor to put me on the witness stand to testify against Jacob. For these reasons, and a dozen more I haven't thought of yet, I close my door and lock it, so that when Detective Mattson passes by again, I don't have to look him in the eye.
Jacob. I wouldn't have thought it possible, but Rich Mattson is not a complete and utter ass. For example, he told me that you can tell the sex of an individual by looking at the skull, because a male skull has a square chin and a female chin is rounded. He told me that he's been to the body farm in Knoxville, Tennessee, where an acre of land is covered with corpses rotting in all different stages, so that forensic anthropologists can measure the effects of weather and insects on human decay. He has pictures and promised to mail me a few. This is still not Dr. Henry Lee worthy, but it makes a decent consolation prize. I learned that he has a daughter who, like Jess, faints at the sight of blood. When I tell him that Jess used to do this too, his face twists, as if he smelled something awful. After a while, I promise him not to call the police on my mother again, unless she is causing me dire bodily harm. And he convinces me that an apology to her might go a long way right now. When I walk him downstairs, my mother is pacing in the kitchen. "Jacob has something to tell you," he announces. "Detective Mattson is going to send me photographs of decomposing bodies," I say. "Not that. The other thing." I push my lips out and then suck them in. I do it twice, as if I'm melting the words in my mouth. I shouldn't have called the cops. Asperger's impulsiveness. My mother's face freezes, and so does the detective's. Only after I've said it do I realize that they're probably assuming Jess's death was Asperger's impulsiveness too. Or in other words, talking about my Asperger's impulsiveness was a bit too impulsive. I think we're all set here, the detective says. You two have a nice evening. My mother touches his sleeve. Thank you. He looks at her as if he's about to tell her something important, but instead he says, You have nothing to thank me for. When he leaves, a lick of cold air from outside wraps around my ankles. Would you like me to make you something to eat? My mother asks. You never had lunch. No thanks. I'm going to lie down, I announce, although I really just want to be alone. I've learned that when someone invites you to do something, and you really don't want to, they don't particularly want to hear the truth. Her eyes fly to my face. Are you sick? I'm fine, I tell her. Really? I can feel her staring at me as I walk up the stairs. I don't plan to lie down, but I do. And I guess I fall asleep because all of a sudden Dr. Henry Lee is there. We're crouched down on either side of Jess's body. He examines the tooth in her pocket, the abrasions on her lower back. He looks up the cavities of her nostrils. Oh, yes, he says, crystal clear. I understand. I can see why you had to do what you did. Case 8. 1 in 6 billion. In the 1980s and 90s, over 50 women in the Seattle-Tacoma, Washington area were murdered. Most of the victims were prostitutes or teen runaways, and most of the bodies were dumped in or near the Green River. Dubbed the Green River Killer, the murderer was unknown until science managed to catch up to crime. In the early 1980s, while performing autopsies on the victims, pathologists and medical technologists were able to recover small amounts of DNA in semen left behind by the killer. These were retained as evidence, but then-current scientific techniques proved worthless, since there wasn't enough material for testing. Gary Ridgway, who was arrested in 1982 on a prostitution charge, was a suspect in the Green River killings. But there wasn't any evidence to formally link him to the crimes. In 1984, he passed a polygraph test. In 1987, while searching his home, the King County Sheriff's Department took a saliva sample from Ridgway. By March 2001, improvements in DNA typing technology had identified the source of the semen on the victims' bodies. In September 2001, the lab received results. They were able to get a comparative match between the DNA in that semen and the DNA in Ridgway's saliva. A warrant was issued for his arrest. The DNA results linked Ridgway to 3 of the 4 women listed as victims in his indictment. Sperm samples taken from one of these victims, Carol Ann Christensen, were so conclusive that not more than one person in the world, excluding identical twins, would exhibit that particular DNA profile. Ridgway was charged with 3 more murders after microscopic paint evidence found with the bodies matched paint at his workplace. In return for confessing to more of the Green River murders, Ridgway was spared the death penalty and is currently serving 48 life sentences with no possibility of parole.
Chapter 8. Oliver. A month later, I am sprawled on the couch in the Hunt's living room, caught in a weird déjà vu. I am scanning the discovery that's been sent to me, which includes Jacob's journals on crime busters, while he sits on the floor in front of me, watching on TV the very same episode I'm reading about. Want me to tell you how it ends? I ask. I already know. Not that that's kept him from writing down yet another journal entry. This one in a brand new composition-style notebook. Episode 49, Sex, Lies, and iMovie. Situation. After a suicide note is spliced into the credits of a feature at a film festival, a B-movie director is found dead in the back of a car. But the team suspects foul play. Evidence. Trailer from festival. Cuttings from editing studio. Who is the blonde? And is she really dead or just acting? Hard drive of director's computer. Director's collection of rare butterflies. Red herring. Entomology not involved. Acid in pipes. Solved by me. O24. You figured it out in 20 minutes?
Yeah.
The butler did it, I say.
No, actually, it's the plumber,
Jacob corrects. So much for making a joke. We've gotten into a routine. Instead of staying at my office during the day, I do my trial preparation here at the Hunts. That way, I can watch Jacob if Emma needs to run out, and I have my client available to answer any questions I've got. Thor likes it because he spends most of the day curled up in Jacob's lap. Jacob likes it because I bring the Wii with me. Theo likes it because if I bring guacamole on Green Monday for his brother, I slip a personal size non-green sausage pizza into the fridge for him. I don't really know if Emma likes it. Theo walks past us in the living room to a file cabinet in the back.
You still doing your homework?
Jacob asks. There's not really any malice in his tone. It's flat, like everything else Jacob says, but Theo flips him the bird. Usually Theo's the one to finish his work first, but today he seems to be dragging. I wait for Jacob to tell him to go fuck himself, but instead he just fixes his glassy gaze on the television again. Hey, I say, approaching Theo. He startles and takes the piece of paper he's scanning and stuffs it into his jeans pocket.
Stop sneaking up on me.
What are you doing in here anyway? Isn't this your mother's file cabinet?
Isn't this none of your business?
Theo says.
No, but Jacob is, and you should apologize.
I should also have 5 servings of vegetables a day, but that rarely happens, he replies, and he heads back into the kitchen to finish his homework. I know Jacob well enough by now to pick up on the cues that flag his emotions. The fact that he's rocking back and forth slightly means whatever Theo just said rattled him more than he's letting on. If you tell your mother he does that shit to you, I say, I can bet you it will stop.
You don't tell on your brother, you take care of him. He's the only one you've got, Jacob recites. It's a rule.
If I could only make the jury see how Jacob lives from one decree to another. If I could make the connection between a kid who won't even break one of his mother's rules, much less the law governing our country. If I could somehow prove that his Asperger's makes it virtually impossible for him to cross that line between right and wrong. Well, I could win his case. Hey, after lunch, I want to talk to you about what's going to happen later this week when we...
Shh,
Jacob says.
The commercial's over.
I flip the page and see an entry that doesn't have an episode number. I start reading, and my jaw drops. Oh, shit, I say out loud. A month ago, after the suppression hearing, I'd called Helen Sharp. I think you need to give up, I told her. You can't prove the case. We're willing to take probation for 5 years. I can win this without the police department confession, she said. I've got all the statements that were made at the house before Jacob was in custody. I have the forensic evidence at the scene and eyewitness evidence that goes to motive. I've got his history of violence and I've got the defendant's journals. At the time, I'd shrugged it off. Jacob's journals were formulaic, and every other piece of evidence she listed was something I could excuse away on cross. We're going forward, Helen had said, and I'd thought, good freaking luck. Here's what the journal says. At her house, 1-12-10. Situation, girl missing. Evidence, clothes in pile on bed. Toothbrush missing. Lip gloss missing. Victim's purse and coat remain. Cell phone missing. Cut screen.
Boot prints outside match up with boyfriend's footwear.
Jesus Christ, Jacob!
I explode, so loud that Emma comes running in from the laundry room.
You wrote about Jess in your Crime Busters journals?
He doesn't respond, so I stand and turn off the TV.
What do you mean?
Emma says. I pass her the photocopy of the notebook.
What were you thinking?
I demand. Jacob shrugs. It was a crime scene, he says simply.
Do you have any idea what Helen Sharp is going to do with this?
No, and I don't care, Emma replies. I want to know what you're going to do about it. She folds her arms and moves a step closer to Jacob.
I don't know, to be honest, because after all the work we did to get the police station statement thrown out, this brings it all back in.
Jacob repeats what I said, and then repeats it again. Brings it all back. Brings it all back. The first time I heard him do it, I thought he was mimicking me. Now I know it's echolalia. Emma explained it to me as just the repetition of sounds. Sometimes Jacob does that by reciting movie quotes, and sometimes it's an immediate parroting of something he's heard. I just hope no one hears him doing it in court, or they'll assume he's a wise ass.
Bring it all back, Jacob says again. Bring what all back?
Something that's going to make the jury assume you're guilty.
But it's a crime scene, Jacob says again. I just wrote down the evidence like usual.
It's not a fictional crime scene, I point out.
Why not? He asks. I'm the one who created it.
Oh my God, Emma chokes. They're going to think he's a monster. I want to put my hand on her arm and tell her I will be able to keep that from happening. But I cannot make that kind of promise. Even having been with Jacob for the past month like I have, there are still things he does that strike me as utterly chilling. Like now, when his mother is hysterical and he turns away without registering any remorse and cranks up the volume on his TV show. Juries, which are supposed to be about reason, are actually always about the heart. A juror who watches Jacob stare blankly through the graphic testimony about Jess Ogilvie's death will deliberate his fate with that image etched in her mind, and it cannot help but sway her decision. I cannot change Jacob, which means I have to change the system. This is why I filed a motion and why we're going to court tomorrow, although I haven't broken the news to Emma yet. I need to tell you both something, I say, as Emma's watch begins to beep.
Hold on, she says. I'm timing Theo on a math quiz.
She faces the kitchen.
Theo? Put your pencil down. Jacob, lower that volume. Theo? Did you hear me?
When there's no answer, Emma walks into the kitchen. She calls out again, and then I hear her footsteps overhead in Theo's room. A moment later, she is back in the living room, her voice wild.
He never did his math quiz, and his coat and sneakers and backpack are missing, she says. Theo's gone.
Theo. Let me just say that I think it's pretty insane that a kid who's 15, like me, can fly across the country without a parent. The hardest part was getting the ticket, which turned out to not be very hard at all. It was no secret that my mother keeps an emergency credit card buried in her file cabinet, and honestly, didn't this count as an emergency? All I had to do was dig it out, get the number off the front and the PIN code on the back, and book my ticket on Orbitz.com. I had a passport, too. We'd driven up to Canada once on a vacation that lasted approximately 6 hours after Jacob refused to sleep in the motel room because it had an orange carpet, which was stored one file folder away from the emergency credit card. And getting to the airport was a piece of cake. It took 2 hitched rides, and that was that. I wish I could tell you I had a plan, but I didn't. All I knew was that, directly or indirectly, this was my fault. I hadn't killed Jess Ogilvie, But I'd seen her the day she died, and I hadn't told the police or my mother or anyone else, and now Jacob was going to be tried for murder. In my mind, it was like a chain reaction. If I hadn't been breaking into houses at the time, if I hadn't been in Jess's, if I had never locked eyes with her, maybe that missing link would have broken the string of events that happened afterward. It was no great secret that my mother was totally freaking out about where the money would be coming from for Jacob's trial. I figured that if I was ever going to remove my karmic debt, I might as well start by finding the solution to that problem. Hence, this visit to my father. On the plane, I'm sitting between a businessman who's trying to sleep and a woman who looks like a grandmother. She's got short white hair and a light purple sweatshirt with a cat on it. The businessman is shifting in his seat because he's got a kid behind him who keeps kicking it. "Jesus H. Christ," he says. I've always wondered why people say that. Why the H? I mean, what if his middle name was Stanley? I'm stuck on the last one, the grandma says. I pull my iPod earphone free. "Sorry?" "No, that doesn't fit." She's hunched over a crossword puzzle in the back of the US Airways magazine. It had been filled out halfway. I hate that. Doesn't the jerk who's sitting in the seat on the previous flight think someone else might want to try it on his own? The clue is regretted, and it's four letters. "Theo," I think. Suddenly, the businessman comes out of his seat and twists around. "Madam," he says to the kid's mom, "is there any chance you could keep your brat from being so incredibly rude?" "That's it," the grandma says. "Rude." I watch her write it in pencil. I think it's spelled differently, I suggest. R-U-E-D. "Right," she says, erasing it to make the correction. I admit to being a horrendous speller. She smiles at me. "Now, what's bringing you out to sunny California?" "I'm visiting someone." "Me too. Someone I've never met. My first grandbaby." "Wow," I say. "You must be pretty stoked." "If that's a good thing, then yes, I guess I am. My name's Edith." "I'm Paul." Okay, I don't know where the lie came from. I shouldn't have been surprised. After all, I'd hidden my involvement in this whole nightmare for over a month now, and I was getting really good at pretending I wasn't the same person I was back then. But once I made up the name, the rest kept coming. I was on school break. I was an only child. My parents were divorced. Ha, not a lie. And I was going to see my dad. We were planning on taking a college tour of Stanford. At home, we don't talk about my father. In world studies class, we learned about indigenous cultures who no longer speak the names of the dead. Well, we no longer say the name of the person who quit when the going got tough. I don't really know the details of my parents' split, except that I was still a baby when it happened, and so of course there's a piece of me that thinks I must have been the straw that broke the camel's back. But I do know that he tries to pay off his guilt by sending my mom a child support check every month, and I also know that he has replaced Jacob and me with two little girls who look like China dolls and who probably have never broken into a house or stimmed a day in their short lives. I know this because he sends us a Christmas card every year, which I throw out if I get to the mail before my mother does. "Do you have brothers or sisters?" Edith asks. I take a sip of the 7-Up I bought for $3. "Nope," I say. "Only child." "Stop it," the businessman says, and for one awful moment I think he's going to tell this woman who I really am. Then he turns around in his seat. "For the love of God," he says to the little kid's mom. "So, Paul," Edith says, "what do you want to study at Stanford?" "I'm 15. I have no idea what I want to do with my life, except fix the mess I've made of it." Instead of answering, I point down at her crossword puzzle. "Quito," I say. That's the answer to 42 across. She gets all excited and reads aloud the next clue. I think about how happy she'll be if we finish this crossword puzzle. She'll get off the plane and tell her son-in-law, or whoever is picking her up, about the nice young man she met. About how helpful I was. How proud my parents must be of me.
This ends Disc 11. House Rules, Disc 12.
Jacob. My brother isn't as smart as I am. I'm not saying this to be mean, I'm just stating a fact. For example, he has to study all his vocabulary words if he wants to do well on a test. I can look at the page and it's stuck in my head for easy retrieval after that first glance. He would leave the room if two adults started discussing adult things like current events. I would just pull up a chair and join the conversation. He doesn't care about storing information away, like a squirrel would save nuts for the winter. It's only interesting to Theo if it has current real-life applications. However, I'm not nearly as intuitive as my brother. This is why when I begin to let some of that stored information bleed free, like, for example, how Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak released the Apple I computer on April Fool's Day, 1976, and the person I'm speaking with begins to go glassy-eyed and make excuses, I'll keep talking, although Theo would easily read the clues and shut up. Being a detective is all about intuition. Being a good crime scene investigator, however, requires great thoroughness and intelligence, which is why, while my mother is rendered immobile by her panic over Theo's disappearance, and Oliver is doing stupid things like patting her shoulder, I go to Theo's bedroom and get on his computer. I'm very good with computers. I once took my guidance counselor's laptop apart and put it back together, motherboard and all. I could probably configure your wireless network in my sleep. Here's the other reason I like computers. When you're talking to someone online, you don't have to read expressions on faces or interpret tones of voice. What you see is what you get. And that means I don't have to try so hard when I interact. There are chat rooms and message boards for Aspies like me, but I don't frequent them. One of the house rules in the family is to not go to websites my mother hasn't vetted. When I asked her why, she made me sit down with her and watch a television show about sexual predators. I tried to explain that the website I wanted to chat on wasn't quite the same thing. That it was only a bunch of people like me trying to connect without all the bullshit that's part of face-to-face meetings. But she wouldn't take no for an answer. "You don't know what these people are like, Jacob," she said to me. In fact, I did. It was the people in the real world I didn't understand. It takes only a few clicks to delve into his cache. Even though he thinks he's emptied it, nothing is ever really gone on a computer. And to see where he was last surfing the net. Orbitz.com, flights to San Jose. When I bring downstairs the printout of the webpage that has his ticket information on it, Oliver is trying to convince my mother to call the police. "I can't," she says. "They won't want to help me." "They don't get to pick and choose their cases." "Mom," I interrupt. "Jacob, not now," Oliver says. "But..." My mother looks at me and starts crying. I watch one tear make an S curve down her cheek. "I want to talk to you," I say. "I'm getting the phone," Oliver says. "I'm dialing 911. "I know where Theo is," I tell them. My mother blinks.
"You what?"
"It was on his computer." I hand her the printed page.
"Oh my God," my mother says, holding her hand up to her mouth. "He's going to Henry's."
"Who's Henry?" Oliver asks. "My father," I answered. "He walked out on us." Oliver takes a step backward and rubs his chin. "He's connecting in Chicago," I add. "His plane leaves in 15 minutes. "You can't catch him before he takes off," Oliver says. "Does Henry know? About Jacob?"
Of course he knows about me. He sends checks every year for my birthday and Christmas. I meant, does Henry know about the murder charge? My mother looks down at the fault line between the cushions of the couch. I don't know. He might have read about it in the papers, but I didn't talk to him about it, she admits. I didn't know how to tell him. Oliver holds out the phone. Now's the time to figure that out, he says. I don't like to think of Theo on a plane. I don't like planes. I understand Bernoulli's principle, but for the love of God, no matter how physical forces are being exerted on the wings for lift, the hardware weighs 1,000,000 pounds. For all intents and purposes, it should fall out of the sky. My mother takes the phone and starts to dial a long-distance number. It sounds like the notes of a game show theme song, but I can't remember which one. Christ, Oliver says. He looks at me. I don't know how I'm supposed to respond. We'll always have Paris, I say. When Theo was 8, he became convinced that there was a monster living underneath the house. He knew this because he could hear its breath every night when the radiators in his room hissed awake. I was 11 and very into dinosaurs at the time. And as thrilling as it was for me to assume that there might be a sauropod rooting around under the foundations of our house, I knew this was not likely. 1. Our house was built in 1973. 2. To build it, there would have been an excavation. 3. The probability of the world's sole long-lost dinosaur surviving the excavation and residing beneath my basement floor would be pretty slim. 4. Even if it had survived, what the hell would it be eating? Grass clippings, Theo said when I told him all this. Duh. One of the reasons I like having Asperger's is that I don't have an active imagination. To many, teachers and guidance counselors and shrinks included, this is a great detriment. To me, it's a blessing. Logical thinking keeps you from wasting time worrying or hoping. It prevents disappointment. Imagination, on the other hand, only gets you hyped up over things that will never realistically happen. Like running into a hadrosaur on your way to the bathroom at 3 a.m. Theo spent 2 weeks freaking out in the middle of the night when he heard the hiss from the heating registers in his room. My mother tried everything, from warm milk before bedtime, to an illustrated diagram of the heating system of the house, to an unnecessary dose of children's Benadryl at night, to knock Theo out. But, like clockwork, he'd start screaming in the middle of the night and would run out of his room and wake both of us. It was getting old, frankly, which is why I did what I did. After my mother tucked me in, I stayed up with a flashlight hidden under my pillow and read until I knew she had gone to bed too. Then I took my pillow and blankets and sleeping bag and camped outside Theo's bedroom door. That night, when he woke up screaming and tried to run to my mother's room to wake her up too, he tripped over me. He blinked for a second, trying to figure out if he was dreaming. "Go back to bed," I said. "There's no stupid dinosaur." I could tell he didn't believe me, so I added, "And if there is, he'll kill me first before he gets to you." This actually worked. Theo crawled back into bed, and we both fell asleep again. My mother was the one who found me sprawled on the floor the next morning. She panicked. Assuming I'd had some kind of seizure, she started shaking me. "Stop, Mom," I finally said. "I'm fine." "What are you doing out here?" "I was sleeping."
"In the hallway?"
"Not the hallway," I corrected. "In front of Theo's room."
"Oh, Jacob, you were trying to make him feel safe, weren't you?"
She threw her arms around me and held me so tight I thought I just might have a seizure after all.
"I knew it," she babbled. "I knew it. All those books, all those idiot doctors who said kids with Asperger's have no theory of mind and can't empathize. You do love your brother.
You wanted to protect him. I let her embrace me because it seemed to be what she wanted to do. Behind Theo's door, I could hear him starting to stir. What my mother had said was not technically inaccurate. What those doctors and books all say about how Aspies like me can't feel anything on behalf of others, that's total bullshit. We understand when someone else is in pain. It just affects us differently than it affects other humans. I see it as the next step of evolution. I can't take away your sadness, so why should I acknowledge it? In addition, I hadn't slept in front of Theo's door because I wanted to protect him. I'd slept in front of his door because I was exhausted after a week of midnight crying, and I only wanted to get a good night's rest. I was looking out for my own best interests. You could say, actually, that this was the impetus behind what happened with Jess, too.
Oliver. Emma wants to call U.S. Airways and make them stop the plane from departing, but the entire system is automated. When we finally do reach a human employee, he's in Charlotte, North Carolina, and has no way of contacting the Burlington Gate. Here's the thing, I tell her. You can beat him there by flying direct to San Francisco. It's almost the same distance to Palo Alto from the San Jose airport. She looks over my shoulder at the computer screen, which has the flight I've found. With the layover in Chicago that Theo's going to make, you'll still get in an hour before he does. She leans forward, and I can smell the shampoo in her hair. Her eyes flicker over the flight information, hopeful, and then land on the bottom, and the price. $1,080? That's ridiculous. Same-day fares aren't cheap. Well, that's not in my budget, Emma says. I click on the button to purchase the ticket. It's in mine. I lie. What are you doing? You can't pay for that. Too late, I shrug. The truth is, financially, I'm a little shaky now. I have one client and she can't afford to pay me, and worse, I'm okay with that. Surely I missed the blood-sucking your client class in law school, since all evidence points to me being the poster boy for financially ruined defense attorneys. But at the same time, I'm thinking that I can sell my saddle. I have a beautiful English one that's in storage below the pizza place. No use having it when I don't have a horse anyway. I'll add it to the bill, I say. But we both know I probably won't. Emma closes her eyes for a moment. I don't know what to say. Then just be quiet. You shouldn't have to get involved in this mess. Lucky for you, the only other thing I had to do today was organize my sock drawer. I joke, but she's not laughing. I'm sorry, Emma replies. It's just, I don't have anyone else. Very slowly, very deliberately, so that she will not startle or pull away, I thread my fingers through hers and squeeze her hand. You have me, I say. If I were a better man, I wouldn't have eavesdropped on Emma's conversation with her ex-husband. Henry, she said, it's Emma. No, actually, I can't really call back later. It's about Theo. He's fine. I mean, I think he's fine. He's run away from home. Well, of course I know that. He's on his way to your place. Yes, California, unless you've moved lately. No, I'm sorry. That wasn't an insult. I don't know why. He just took off. He used my credit card. Look, can we just talk about this when I get there? Oh, did I forget to mention that? If all goes well, I'll land before Theo. Meeting us at the airport would be great. We're both on U.S. Airways. Then there is a hesitation. Jacob? She replies. No, he won't be joining me. It is decided that I will camp out for the night to be the over 25 adult watching Jacob while Emma hauls Theo's ass back across the country. At first, after she leaves, it seems like a piece of cake. We can play the Wii. We can watch TV. And thank God, it's Brown Thursday, which is relatively easy. I can cook Jacob a burger for dinner. It isn't until an hour after she leaves that I remember my hearing tomorrow. The one I had not yet told Emma about. The one I will have to take Jacob to by myself. Jacob, I say while he is engrossed in a television show about how Milky Way bars are made. I have to talk to you for a second. He doesn't respond. His eyes don't even flicker from the screen. So I step in front of it and turn it off. I just want to have a little chat. When Jacob doesn't answer, I keep speaking. Your trial starts in a month, you know.
A month and 6 days.
Right. Well, I've been thinking about how hard it might be for you to be in court all day long, and I figured we need to do something about it.
Oh, Jacob says, shaking his head. I can't be in court all day. I have schoolwork to do, and I have to be home by 4:30 so that I can watch Crime Busters.
I don't think you get it. It's not your call. You go to court when the judge says you go to court, and you get to come home when he's ready to let you go. Jacob chews on this information.
That's not going to work for me.
Which is why you and I are going back to court tomorrow.
But my mother's not here.
I know that, Jacob. I didn't plan for her to be away, but the fact of the matter is, the whole reason we're going is something you said to me.
Me?
Yes. Do you remember what you told me when you decided I could run an insanity defense? Jacob nods.
That the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination by the state or local governments, including the courts, he says, and that some people consider autism to be a disability, even if I don't happen to be one of them.
Right. But if you do consider Asperger's syndrome to be a developmental disability, then under the ADA, you're also entitled to provisions in court that will make the experience easier for you. I let a slow smile loose, like a card that's been played close to the chest. Tomorrow, we're going to make sure you get them.
Emma. From Auntie M's column archives. Dear Auntie M, recently I've been dreaming about my ex. Should I consider this a sign from a higher power and call him to say hi? Sleepless in Stratford. Dear Sleepless, yes, but I wouldn't tell him you're calling because he's starring in your dreams. Unless he happens to say, gosh, it's so strange that you called today because I dreamed about you last night. Auntie M. I asked Henry out on our first date because he didn't seem to be picking up on hints that I was his for the taking. We saw the movie Ghost and went out to dinner afterward, where Henry told me that, scientifically, ghosts could simply not exist. It's basic physics and math, he said. Patrick Swayze couldn't walk through walls and tag along behind Demi Moore. If ghosts can follow someone, that means their feet apply force to the floor. If they go through walls, though, they don't have any substance. They could be either material or be unmaterial, but they can't be both at the same time. It violates Newton's rule. He was wearing a t-shirt that said, Full Frontal Nerdity, and his corn silk hair kept falling into his eyes. But don't you wish it could be true? I asked him. Don't you wish love was so strong it could come back to haunt you? I told him the story of my mother, who one night had woken up at 3:14 a.m. with a mouth full of violet petals and the scent of roses so thick in the air that she couldn't breathe. An hour later, she was roused by a phone call. Her own mother, a florist by trade, had died of a heart attack at 3:14 a.m. Science can't answer everything, I told Henry. It doesn't explain love. Actually, it does, he told me. There have been all kinds of studies done, People are more attracted to people with symmetrical features, for example, and symmetrical men smell better to women. Also, people who have similar genetic traits are attracted to each other. It probably has something to do with evolution. I burst out laughing. That is awful, I said. That is the most unromantic thing I've ever heard.
I don't think so.
Oh, really? Say something that will sweep me off my feet, I demanded. Henry looked at me for a long moment, until I could feel my head growing lighter and dizzier.
I think you might be perfectly symmetrical, he said.
On our second date, Henry took me to Boston. We had dinner at the Parker House, and then he hired a hansom cab to take us around the Boston Common. It was late November, and frost crouched in the bare branches of the trees. When we settled into the back of the carriage, the driver handed us a heavy wool blanket to put over our laps. The horse was spirited, stamping its feet and snorting. Henry was telling me riddles.
The ratio of an igloo's circumference to its diameter?
I give up.
Eskimo pie, he said. How about half of a large intestine?
I don't know.
A semicolon.
That's not a math or science joke, I said.
I'm a Renaissance guy, Henry laughed. 8 nickels?
I shook my head.
2 paradigms, he said.
The puns weren't, by definition, funny. But on Henry's lips, they were. Lips that were curved at the ends, and that always seemed a little embarrassed to smile. Lips that had kissed me goodnight on our first date with a surprising amount of force and intensity. I was staring at his lips when the horse dropped dead. Technically, it wasn't dead. It had slipped on a patch of black ice and its front legs had buckled. I had heard one snap. We rolled in slow motion out of the hansom cab, Henry twisting so that he would cushion my fall. You all right? He asked, and he helped me to my feet. He held the rough blanket around me while the police came and then animal control. Don't watch, Henry whispered, and he turned my face away when the officer pulled out a pistol. I tried to focus on the words on Henry's t-shirt, where his coat was gaping open. Does this proton make my mass look fat? But the sound was like the world cracking in half. And the last thing I remember was wondering who wore a t-shirt in the winter, and if that meant his skin was always warm, and if I would ever get to lie against it. I woke up in an unfamiliar bed. The walls were cream-colored, and there was a dresser made of dark wood with a television on it. It was very clean and corporate. You fainted, I told myself. The horse, I said out loud. A voice said quietly.
He's in that big carousel in the sky?
I rolled over to find Henry pressed against the far wall, still wearing his coat. You don't believe in heaven, I murmured.
No, but I figured you would. Are you okay?
I nodded gingerly, testing.
What's wrong? Don't women swoon around you all the time?
He grinned.
It was a little Victorian of you.
Where are we?
I got a room at the Parker House. I thought you might need to lie down for a while.
His cheeks bloomed a bright red.
I don't want you to get the wrong idea, though.
I came up on an elbow. You don't?
Well, not unless you want me to. he stammered. "Well, that's a little gothic," I said. "Henry, can I ask you something?"
"Okay."
"What are you doing all the way over there?" I held out my hand and felt the mattress give under his weight as Henry crawled onto it. I felt his mouth come down against mine, and I realized that this relationship wouldn't be what I'd imagined it to be. Me, playing teacher to the shy young computer science geek. I should have known from watching Henry work at the office. Programmers moved slowly and deliberately, and then waited to see the reaction. And if they didn't succeed the first time, they would try over and over again until they broke through that fifth dimension and got it right. Later, when I was wearing Henry's t-shirt and his arms were wrapped around me, when we had turned on the television and were watching a show on primates in the Congo with the volume muted, when he had fed me chicken nuggets from the kids' room service menu, I thought how clever I'd been to see past what other people saw in Henry. The silly t-shirts, the Star Wars canteen in which he stored his coffee, the way he could barely look a woman in the eye. Beneath that exterior was a man who touched me as if I were made of glass, who focused with such intensity on me that sometimes I had to remind him to breathe when we were making love. I never imagined at the time that Henry wouldn't be able to love anything other than me, not even a baby he'd made. I never imagined that all that passion between us would pool beneath the tangled threads of Jacob's genetic code, waiting for just the perfect storm to dig in its roots, to burst and blossom into autism. Henry's waiting for me when I get off my plane. I walk toward him, stopping an awkward foot away. I lean forward to embrace him just as he turns away toward the arrivals monitor, which means I close my arms around nothing but air. "He should be landing in 20 minutes, Henry says. "Good," I reply. "That's good." I look at him. "I'm really sorry about this." Henry stares down the empty corridor past the security barrier. "You going to tell me what's going on, Emma?" For 5 minutes, I tell him about Jess Ogilvie, about the murder charge. I tell him I'm sure Theo's escape had something to do with all of this. When I'm finished, I listen to the call for a passenger about to miss his plane, and then muster the courage to meet Henry's gaze. "Jacob's on trial for murder?" he says, his voice shaky. "And you didn't mention it?" "What would you have done?" I challenge. "Fly back to Vermont to be our white knight? Somehow I doubt that, Henry." "And when this hits the papers out here, how am I supposed to explain to my 7 and 4-year-old that their half-brother is a murderer?" I reel back as if he slapped me. "I'm going to pretend you didn't just say that," I murmur. "And if you knew your son at all, if you had ever actually spent time with Jacob instead of just sending a check every month to ease your conscience, you'd know that he's innocent." A muscle ticks in Henry's jaw. "Do you remember what happened on our 5th anniversary? That time of my life, when we were trying every intervention and therapy possible to get Jacob to connect with the world again, is a dark blur. We were out at a movie, the first time we'd been alone in months. And suddenly the strange man walks down the aisle and crouches down and starts talking to you. And a minute later, you walk out with him. I sat there thinking, who the hell is this guy and where's my wife going with him? And I followed you into the lobby. Turned out that he was the father of our babysitter and an EMT. Livy had called him in a panic because Theo was bleeding like crazy. He went to the house, put a butterfly bandage on Theo, and came and got us. I stare at Henry. I don't remember any of this. Theo wound up getting 10 stitches in his eyebrow, Henry says, because Jacob had gotten angry and knocked over his high chair when Livy had her back turned. Now it is coming back to me. The panic we came home to with Jacob in total meltdown mode, and Theo hysterically crying, a knot the size of his tiny fist rising over his left eye. Henry making the hospital run, while I was left behind to calm Jacob. I wonder how it's possible to put something so far out of one's mind, to rewrite history. I can't believe I forgot that, I say softly. Henry glances away from me. You were always good at seeing what you wanted to see, he answers. And then suddenly, we both notice our son. What the hell? Theo says. I fold my arms.